And without any further ado, my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Dr. Glass.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you again. Let's have some fun today, because this is a very, very serious subject. So let's try to make light of it a little bit so we can get through what is possibly the most serious subject in all of medicine, and that's dealing with end-of-life issues. So I put in a whole bunch of slides over here to try to lighten the mood a little bit, and I entitled this first slide, Poor Choices. This lady missed the boat. It's a real slide. These aren't Photoshopped slides. And sometimes some very, very poor choices. And what this talk, and I'm thrilled to be performing today with Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who's a good friend and a big Talmud Chacham, and it's an honor to really share this showcase with him today. And he can teach you a tremendous amount about this subject as well, and we'll try not to overlap too much. But in life, one needs to know when and how to make the end-of-life decisions, and it's never too early. So we have the concept of Shuv Yom Echad Mimosecha, you should do tshuva the day before you die, and the Gemara says, well, we don't know when we're going to die, so do tshuva right now. So end-of-life decisions should be made today, even though B'ezus Hashem, our end-of-life won't be for many, many, many years. Because if you make those end-of-life decisions sometimes too late, when you're really at the end of life, you can't make them rationally, you can't make them yourself, because you may not be competent or capable of making them at that point because of the underlying illness, and the people and or the hospital and or the others that then make those decisions may make terrible decisions for you and may make terrible decisions from a halachic point of view. So, one of the things I'd like to focus on is quality of life, how we define that and how that determines what decisions we make, and really, therefore, answer the question, whose life is it anyway, which I believe was a famous movie and book. So that's a critical halachic question, which I dare say halacha has a very totally different answer than secular ethics. And I know secular ethics is also a myriad of different opinions, but I'll put secular ethics in as anything that is anti-halacha, not that secular ethics are always anti-halacha. So when I do point out secular ethics, it's not necessarily that they all agree to that, but there is a body or some that say some of those things, and that's why I'll call them secularists, even though that's not a uniform or monolithic opinion. And in fact, some secular ethicists are kehalacha. But I want to contrast today a lot of the halachic and secular viewpoints in terms of end of life. And the question that always arises in the hospital is, do these coexist? Can halacha and medicine coexist? And those of you that practice, and those of you that are in an ICU setting and making life and death decisions every day, are aware that the people that don't have a Torah guiding their decisions, a Rav who's competent guiding their decisions, end up making decisions that are frequently at odds with halacha. And they're doing it from a good place. They're doing it from their heart. I don't think they're bad people. I actually don't think Dr. Kevorkian is a bad person. Totally misguided. But I don't think he's a bad person. I think that people that do all sorts of things for mercy are very, very, very misguided, but they're doing it because of Havas Reachem. They're doing it because they love their fellow man, and under their very misguided, I can't say that enough times, under their very misguided non-Torah approach, they think they're doing the right things. And that leads you to the slippery slopes, and that leads you to all sorts of halachic problems. And the question really is, can they coexist? Can you coexist with the intensivist in your unit who says this is a waste of resources? There's a guy in the East, in the ED that needs this bed and this ventilator and this nurse and et cetera, et cetera. And why are we wasting, quote, this resource on this 95-year-old guy who's lived Baruch Hashem, they don't say Baruch Hashem, a very nice life. And he's ready to die. He wants to die. This and that. Those are the questions. Can they coexist? And I think that they can. I think, and I actually taught a course at Einstein, developed and taught a course at Einstein called Faith and Medicine, I think that they don't have any problems. I don't think that you have any halachic dilemmas being a physician in modern day medicine. I think you have lots of shaylas, but I don't think that there's any coexisting problems. You have lots and lots and lots of shaylas. But I don't think there ever is a situation where you can't answer your shaylah or have somebody help you answer your shaylah. And therefore, to me, they coexist perfectly. Whereas a lot of secular-based people think that there's this Jewish viewpoint, which is wrong, and then there's our compassionate viewpoint. And I think nothing is further from the truth. This is one of my favorite slides. And you see here a 1600 bathtub. In the 1500s, baths consisted of a big tub filled with hot water. The man of the house had the privilege of being the first one to take the bath. Then his sons and other men of the house. And then the women. And then finally the children. And last of all, the babies. The water was so dirty at this point in time, as you might imagine. Imagine mikveh on Erev Yom Kippur at 4 in the afternoon for the men. The water was so dirty you could actually lose someone in it, and hence the saying, don't throw the baby out with the bath water. That's where that expression comes from. There's a lot in this talk that's critically important, and sometimes people in their overriding compassion, doctors are compassionate in general, although I know exceptions. And Jewish people are compassionate in general. One of the definitions of being a Jewish person is that you're a rachman and a gomlei chesed. So all of us, when we're taking care of patients, and all of us when we're doing all sorts of things for patients, are doing it from the goodness of our heart, and we always must remember, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The Torah defines goodness, not us. That's an overriding principle. If a person is not careful about that, he's going to end up doing a lot of damage. Practical ethics for everybody. Everybody gets treated with respect. Everyone gets treated compassionately. Don't compromise your beliefs. The discussion came up, I believe, last night. You should never, ever, ever, and at least in New York, you're protected. I can't tell you about Canada. I'm not sure about other states if it's the same. In New York, you're not mechuyev to do anything that goes against your religion. You don't have to participate in any activity, weaning a patient, what we call the terminal wean, which is basically pulling the plug, if you don't feel that it's appropriate halachically. And even though it's your patient, somebody else will have to take care of that patient. You're not mechuyev to do anything. You don't have to assist in a procedure. You don't have to do anything. You have to respect other people, but you don't have to compromise your own. And I always stress to the residents, you can disagree with the patient's practices. Yes, you're overeating, you're not exercising, you're not doing the right thing, but you never disagree that they're a person and you've got to treat everybody with respect. That's a basic thing. I talked about this a little bit more previously, about the obligation to stay healthy. I quoted earlier the Rambam, I quoted Shulchan Aruch. That's clear that you have to do that. I want to contrast now Jewish versus secular ethics. And a little bit, Rabbi Steinberg discussed this last night so beautifully, so I'll go through this quickly. There are these four cardinal values that secularist ethicists talk about: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. How do they fit with how the Torah viewpoint? Secular world, the patient decides everything. In the Jewish world, halacha decides everything. In the times of Sanhedrin, with the Beis Din, with all the halachas being carried out the way they're supposed to be, I think Beis Din has the right to strap you down sometimes and do things to you that in American society they would get them thrown in jail for assault, etc. Halacha, at least in theory, can strap a person down and tell you, you have to give this, you have to do that, because that's what the halacha demands. I'm not saying practically, but there is that distinction. In secular society, the patient's essentially competent. In the United States, you can't do anything to that patient that he doesn't want or she doesn't want done to him or her. It's very subjective. In Jewish law and halacha, yeah, there is subjectivity. There is some level of autonomy, but certainly less. Here in beneficence, there's not that much of a difference. Although in halacha, again, we view the person as not being the owner of your body. You're not a baal on your body. HaKadosh Baruch Hu owns your body, and therefore there are certain things that you don't control, even though secular society, secular law, would say that you do. That's an important perspective, and I won't go into that much now. Both secular and Jewish have to say, don't do something. I just, again, read you earlier this morning from the Rambam and codified in Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat that you're not allowed to do something that is, in fact, dangerous. And as a physician, you're not allowed to do something to your patient that's dangerous. So the golden rule of primum non nocere, don't harm your patients. Before you give them something, make sure you've studied and done adequate work to make sure that the patient's going to benefit as best as you can expect. That doesn't mean you only give drugs that have 100% efficacy and 0% side effects. There is no such drug. However, you have to do your homework. You have to make sure that you're confident that what you're doing is in the best interest of the patients, it won't hurt them. Halacha says you can take certain risks. Halacha codifies what those risks are to a certain extent, and there is a certain amount of autonomy. At both extremes, theoretically, there is no autonomy. If something is 100% helpful and has no risk, halacha would demand that you do it. On the other hand, if something was essentially not efficacious, maybe a 0.001 chance, and a vada is going to hurt you, halacha would not allow you to. And where you draw those two margins, how much does something have to be? That's where you really have both discussion in halacha amongst the poskim, and where you have autonomy for the patient. In secular society, theoretically, there are no limits on either end. Withholding versus withdrawing treatment is something also that I think there's a difference between halacha and secular viewpoint. I have had this explained to me, and I still don't understand this, by numerous people in the secular ethical world, and they say that there is no difference from their viewpoint in withholding or withdrawing a treatment. For example, if you put somebody on a respirator, they don't see any problem taking that respirator off or not putting that respirator on. They view them as the same. Halacha clearly distinguishes between not starting a therapy and stopping a therapy that has already started. It's a major difference and has tremendous ramifications in ICUs or other places where a patient is on a certain therapy. And now let's get to the end of life part. This is a true picture. Again, I hate to say this is a lady. I don't mean that in a bad way, but she drove away from the pump and forgot to disengage. And I call this knowing when to let go. And in halacha, there isn't always clear unanimity amongst the poskim as to when to let go. And it's sometimes extremely difficult to let go when we should allow a patient to succumb to their illness and disease, even though we may have some mechanism of keeping them alive a little bit longer. And it's a very difficult decision to make. One more point, justice. In halacha, we view basically a first-come, first-served approach, and I don't get into triage. I know there's another talk about that. I forgot already by who later on in the conference shiurim. But there is an idea here that's also critically important, that life is of infinite value. We believe Chai Yishah is important, so much so. I mean, people understand that, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos. Why? Because it's better that you mechala one Shabbos, more uses this language, so you can be mekayim 100 Shabbosos, 1,000 Shabbosos the rest of your life. But then the question arises, what happens if the guy's going to die before next Shabbos? So the answer is, halacha allows you to desecrate Shabbos for living till 3 o'clock. A house falls on a person at 10 o'clock in the morning. You'll have to desecrate Shabbos to go get him out, even though you have 100% idea that this guy is not going to survive. Your experience, you think you have thousands of such patients, every single one died within 5 hours. I'm setting up a somewhat ridiculous scenario, but halacha still in that situation is allow you to pull out all the things, do all the yisurim on Shabbos to save that guy for an hour. He's not going to ever observe another Shabbos. Chai Yishah to us is of infinite value. And therefore, that's when to let go. If one extra minute is of infinite value, do everything for everybody, because a minute's a minute. But that's not 100% true in terms of the individual, and where and how you're allowed to make those decisions is what we're going to talk about now. So how do you define quality of life, or quali? So is it a small mammal in Australia? A gale force storm? Amount of the time one spends with the kids, that's quality. Quality adjusted life years, that's what it is. The qualities. And the question is, can we put a value on life? Studies nowadays, they have qualities. How much does it cost per quality? Quality adjusted life years. It's a process that I'm very much against in terms of how we evaluate a study. because what exactly does it mean? I mean, would any of us not want to be around for a chasana for a grandchild? Even if we were not in the best of shape? And the secular world says you're not a productive, functioning person of society. So all you'll be able to do is smile underneath the chuppah. You can't contribute anything else. So how do you define quality of life, even by their standards? Never mind by our halachic standards. And you have all these issues, which every one of these comes up in anybody who's taking care of patients with end of life. How do you define what's quality of life? Who decides what? How do you deal with pain and suffering? Halach is very, very insistent that people shouldn't be in pain and suffering. This is forgotten. Halacha demands that you take care of patients' pain and suffering. You're not allowed to have a patient that's suffering. People forget about that. Well, we either have to kill you, or we have to let you suffer. No, there's a huge in-between ground. There's a whole specialty now, pain management. And they're underutilized. And if you don't have the expertise yourself, get somebody who does. There's no reason a patient should be in pain. And you can push the parameters of giving morphine and giving morphine. Maybe something might happen. If you can't do it with the intention that that should happen. But you're allowed to go and push all the variables to the extreme that you would medically, if this was an 18-year-old kid, you can do the same thing for a 98-year-old kid. You have to make sure that patients die with dignity, but die with dignity defined by halacha and not defined by dignity by secular society. How do we define euthanasia? So euthanasia is defined in Dorland's medical dictionary as a mercy killing. And the Torah describes it as murder, ritzicha. In mercy killing is defined in Torah's ritzicha. Whether you can be punished mises based on or not is irrelevant. The Torah defines many types of murder that aren't punishable by mises based. And if you kill with a gun, you walk into the ICU and you start shooting in the ICU, every one of those patients will say is a trefa. Let's assume that. And none of them are going to live 12 months. You're in the palliative care unit. And by definition, they have 6 months or less to live. And you walk in there with a machine gun and shoot everybody, you can't get mises based in. Are you a rotzeach? Of course you are. You're going to burn in hell? Of course you are. That's awesome. So mises based in has nothing to do with whether something is ritzicha or not. That's a technicality. If you didn't give hasorah, you also can't give mises based in. So the act of giving mises based in has nothing to do with your rotzeach. And the Torah defines, if you kill somebody, that is called misa ritzicha. You don't have an option of mercy killing. So is there ever a middle ground, and should there be a middle ground? So I've gone through this already several times, I won't go through it again. You're not allowed to do anything to hurt anybody, whether that's active or passive. You're not allowed to intentionally hurt somebody. But in the end of life, you're not necessarily mechuyev to do everything possible for every single patient. And where it becomes hard is to know which patients you don't have to do every single thing under the sun. And I always work with the assumption that you're mechuyev to do everything until you know not. And that's why I'm very aggressive on people that come into the ED, because I can't tell you how many times the neurologists and the neurosurgeons and everybody else said, oh, this bleed is terrible, and this guy's not walking out of here, and this guy's going to be a vegetable. And then one guy in my shul, I happened to have taken care of him, came in with a car wreck, literally. It was late at night coming home. He's a lawyer coming home with a cab late at night. The cab driver got into a horrible accident on Rockaway Turnpike, and the kid, my hospital happened to have been the trauma center nearby at that time, and he was brought in and didn't look good. And he was in our ICU for 2-3 months, and now Baruch Hashem, I've just had his kid's bar mitzvah a few weeks ago. He's dancing and everything. He's back to being a lawyer, which some would say was mentally damaged, but we'll leave that aside. He's a vibrant quality of life, according to any definition of quality of life. And he would have been written off by many people because he had a terrible, terrible brain damage. So withholding treatment might be allowed under certain situations, but when you're not sure, especially in acute emergency situations. I can't believe sometimes I get these shilas. People ask me, we want to make him a DNR. Well, what happened? Well, he just came into the ER. They're asking us to sign the DNR. He's there for an hour. This is what they're worried about? We're not talking about a person who has an underlying acute or chronic problem. We're talking about an acute illness. The guy just came in. He just had the car accident. Just had the stroke. Just had the major MI. That's not the time to be discussing DNR. Because it's impossible. Eddie's a great emergency room physician. Even Rabbi Dr. Eichlin can't predict which patient's going to live or not live after they're in the ED for an hour. Be right a lot of the time, but that's not good enough to be right a lot of the time in halacha when it's life or death. So when do you do these things? When can you withhold high-tech treatment, low-tech treatment, food and water, even oxygen? These are critically important questions. And I arbitrarily, it's my own system of defining them, you can agree or disagree, high-tech. High-tech stuff, you've got a lot more room to withhold. I don't think there's any halachic opinion that would mandate a 105-year-old Alzheimer's patient with intractable pain and cancer that you should do a surgical procedure on them that is not immediate concern for them. They had some cholecystitis a year ago and you want to take out their gallbladder. I don't think any halachic opinion would mandate doing that. It may prolong his life because maybe he'll get ridiculous. When you start dealing with surgery, chemotherapy, yeah, we can do salvage chemotherapy. This is a 15th tier, and it's shown in one study to give 3 weeks additional life with 2 weeks painful versus nothing. When you get down to these levels, there's a lot of room, obviously, to withhold therapy. And again, it's up to the individual. If you're of that philosophy and type, Chai Yishon means to me living a single extra second with pain and suffering because that's somehow good for my neshama, so halacha allows that. The only thing halacha wouldn't allow is something that would significantly, potentially kill you right now versus something that would not kill you right now. So halacha doesn't give you the right to take a procedure that's going to be a 98% mortality on the table because you're going to die in 3 months and it has a 4 month chance of extra survival. So again, these numbers I'm making up, but that's the idea. You're not mukhayif to take experimental therapy that has risk. You're not mukhayif to take painful therapy. Again, you're allowed to. You're not mechuyev to if this is not really curative and you're dealing with a patient who's chronic who doesn't really have much life expectancy. You're certainly not mechuyev to do CPR. It's a fallacy and a mistake to think that every single patient needs to have a DNR. Is not allowed to have a DNR. Many patients are halachically, I would even say, almost obligated to have a DNR because it's not really going to help. And where does it say anyplace that you have to go to your maker with broken ribs? If the medical treatment is futile, so halacha doesn't demand doing futile treatment. So if something is truly futile, then you don't have to do it. There is no obligation to suffer. That's a critical thing. Just because I can prolong your life for a week doesn't mean I'm mechuyev to. Again, I think it's important to recognize that there are poskim that say that that extra week of suffering has tremendous benefit. And we know that punishment in this world is much better than punishment in the world to come. And the Gemara in Bracha says, don't ask for Yisurim. I don't want them. I don't want their schar. At the same time, when we get them, we're supposed to accept them, be Abba. But you're not mechuyev to ask for them. And you're not mechuyev to do things that will make you have more Yisurim. But if somebody wishes to undergo painful procedures that may extend their life, gesundheit, they're allowed to. Again, as with everything, rabbinic advice is essential. Lower tech, I arbitrarily call this list of things, doing all sorts of what we would say almost routine or more routine, but still technological. You can't give IV antibiotics at home. I know you can, but a person doesn't go, I'm going to go to the refrigerator and get some IV antibiotics for myself. You need to have a whole system in place. It's a technological but low tech type of thing. And these things already, which are more of a maintenance, more poskim would insist that you should do that as a routine, but again, not to say that it's an absolute. There definitely are situations where there are definitely poskim that would not require you to do these things. There are definitely poskim that would say that you're mechuyev to do these things. You've got to ask shailas, and you have to know who the poskim of that patient is. That's very important, because you have five patients in your ICU, and they're all five from people, five different rabbanim. You can have five different piskei halacha for all of them, and each one is correct. Asei lo charab. They have to follow what their Rav says for them to do. I would always go by the patient's posek, assuming that person is appropriate. And if you as a doctor have a problem with doing that, so then you can withdraw from the case. If the patient says, I want you to pull the tube, my doctor says you're allowed to do that, my Rav says you're allowed to do that. So if you feel uncomfortable doing that, then you should withdraw from the case. But it's the patient's posek, in my opinion, that you should be following. And you as a doctor then have to ask your posek, can I follow that advice? But you have situations, for example, with a transplant, where poskim will deny the halachic status of brain death, allow a person who doesn't hope for brain death to accept a transplant from somebody who was taking that organ from them because their poskim does hope for brain death. So it sounds like it's a stira, but it's not. You follow your posik, the patient can follow his posik. In general, you can, under certain circumstances, I believe, withhold some of these low-tech treatments. You need to ask your posik. It's not a vadai, it shouldn't be done willy-nilly, but there definitely is room under selected situations to withhold low-tech treatment. Ask your posik. Withholding food and water is even a more basic need, and many more poskim will say you should not withhold these therapies. Again, I'm not getting into the debate here, are they medically futile or not? I'm assuming that they're not medically futile. Medically futile therapy is medically futile. We're not even discussing that. I'm talking about where, and assuming that medicine thinks this will have some positive benefit. So there are extenuating circumstances even here where I believe poskim will allow you to even withdraw under very rare circumstances. Again, you got to ask shilas. But in general, these things are usually not withheld and almost always are not stopped. There are halachic situations where I know great gedolei poskim that have allowed even withdrawing sometimes a feeding tube or other types of therapy. There are also ways to get around it, not withdrawing it, which you'll hear about. For example, putting things on a timer, not switching the bags when the bag runs out. Lav dafki, you have to put up another bag of Epi or another bag of dopamine or whatever you're putting up. Again, same thing with oxygen, more or less the same thing. Pain and suffering are, again, something that's so critical. Halacha demands that patients not have psychological or physical suffering. It's a halacha. It's not a philosophy. It's not a good idea. It's not secular ethics. Halacha demands that people be without pain. And the last thing I want to talk about is the halachic proxy. A Living Will is a very nice, fine, wonderful document. I think it's relatively unimportant compared to a halachic proxy. What do I mean by halachic proxy? Is a person should designate, when they're still of a healthy, sound mind and body, who they want to make decisions for them when they're incapable of doing so themselves. How, in a nutshell, as you all know who practice, this basically becomes the patient. They're not sick, but they become the patient. When the patient is not able to make decisions, whoever they designate as their proxy makes all the decisions. And you can even go so far as to say that they can reverse a decision that the patient made. So the patient said, yes, do this. The proxy can say, no, don't do that. Because once the patient is no longer capable, the proxy becomes the patient. Therefore, it's critical that you pick as your proxy somebody who has your hashkofa, will use your rabbonim, and obviously somebody that's a Shomer Torah mitzvos. And this happens all the time within families where they don't decide a proxy, and you have the three kids that went to Lakewood, and the three kids that went to Yeshivas Rebbeinu Yitzchak Chanan, and the three kids that went to the local conservative shul, and all nine of the kids come in there, and guess what? They're nine different post-kim, and what do you do? And it's a disaster. It breaks up families. Pick the one that's your hashkofa. Pick the one that you know will follow your rav. Don't go crazy with, I want this scenario, I want this, I want this scenario, I want that. I think it's impossible to figure out all these things. Either trust somebody or you don't. You're trusting with your life. Pick somebody that has your hashkofa. Don't wait until it is too late. You can't squeeze some of these things through. And the bottom line is, use common sense. Everything in life has to be with common sense. A lot of these shilas, what do you want to do? It is going to depend on the individual person. And if you're the proxy for somebody else, if you're the physician taking care of them, some of it is common sense. It's always based upon halacha, but know when to ask a shilah. That's really common sense. I won't go through this. I'm running out of my time. I have two cases. I won't go through them now. If we have time in the question and answers, I can talk about some of the principles. These cases are in the packets. You're welcome to read them and ask me questions about it. I'm supposed to end at 12:15, so I have 2 or 3 minutes left. These two cases are, I think, illustrative of some of the principles that I said. But the bottom line is, if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. And one of my favorite slides, the guy puffing away on a cigarette while his slave, I'll call her, I don't know if it's wife or his girlfriend, is doing all the hard work. When you are taking care of a patient, you have to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And physicians need to know that they're not God. Physicians need to know that they need to ask their poskim what to do. As mentioned in one of the earlier shurim, you have to have the rav. Yeah, you have to have a list of rabbanim that you can call at 24/7 and find out Rebbe, what should I be doing in this situation? Professor Abraham, Rabbi Dr. Abraham, the author of the Nishmas Avraham, said every day he would go to Rav Shlomo Zalman when he was alive and say, Rebbe, what should I do about this case? And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, you just asked me the same type of patient. Yes, he said, but Rebbe, it's a new patient. I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing. So I don't know if you have to ask the same Shiloh over and over and over, but certainly if it's a new Shiloh, ask Shilohs. You have to have poskim on your speed dial. Everybody has their family on the speed dial. Your posek has to be on your speed dial. You have to know who to ask and have the ability to ask Shilohs, because these come up 24/7. And the best thing is to have all these shilas worked out as much as you can in advance when it's daytime and when you have easy access to people, rather than suddenly it's 2 o'clock in the emergency room at night and you don't have easy access and you're suddenly left in limbo. And again, I could give many illustrations of this, but I want to listen to what Rabbi Dr. Eddie Rachman has to say. I think we're taking questions at the end of both of our presentations, so I'm not running away. And Mirza Hashem, I'll also be here for Shabbos, so if we don't get to any of my case discussions or to any of the shilas, if you'd like to ask, feel free to stop me. I thank you all for listening so much. Have a wonderful day.